Nice to see all of you. Just as a reminder, we are the series dedicated to the recovery of the community and the rest of Klal Yisrael and the world in terms of the economy. And Mitzvah Hashem, our learning of business ethics should have an effect on everyone else and their shmira, their keeping of these types of these mitzvos, as well as the improvement of the economy in general. Again, a thank you to Shlomo Sagir and the Sagir family, and your wife, I'm sure.
I'm welcome.
See her.
What? I mean, welcome you properly this time.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And again, akaras hatov to your whole family for letting us come. And thank you again, retroactively to all those in the past who I may have forgotten to express our akaras hatov to that have offered your houses the past couple weeks. I thank you now, if I forgot to thank you before, and we all thank you.
Double star for hosting.
Oh, double star.
Double star now. David
Schulman
will be hosting next week.
Oh, Yashikov to you also.
Is that like Hashem?
Okay. Let me just start with a couple minutes of Hashkafa at the beginning, which I think is we'll do for the next couple of shiurim. As you see, the title here is of the shiur is Whistleblowing and Reporting Offenders to the law agencies. So I'll just take one paragraph from the Mesilas Yesharim about the issues, which, as we'll see a little later on, are related to this question, and that is the issue of Rechilus and Lashon Hara, which we discussed a little bit previously. We'll discuss a little bit more today, but just one Hashkafa paragraph from the Mesilas Yesharim. Of course, the Chafetz Chaim wrote an entire sefer on this topic, but it was easier to find one paragraph in the Mesilas Yesharim than to pick out one paragraph from an entire book. So here we go. I'll just read it. I'll read it quickly outside. You can listen carefully. Harechilus v'lashon hara kfar chamro no da. Rechilus and lashon hara. Rechilus and lashon hara are different aspects, as we know, of saying negative things, not nice things about other people. Again, we're not going to the details now, just the basic idea from a hashkafic perspective. Its severity is already known. V'godol anafav ki rabu ma'od. And all the details are numerous, because there are many of them. Ad shekvar gazru omer chachamim ezirchonam levracha b'ma'amar shekvar hiskarti. The Mesilas Yesharim mentioned this a little bit earlier in his sefer. V'chulam bavak lashon hara, that every single person, all of the Jewish people, have stumbled in some form on the aveira of avak lashon hara, of the not even the direct sin of lashon hara, but rather avak lashon hara, which literally is translated as the dust of lashon hara. And the Gemara says, "Be'amru hechi dami avak lashon hara." And the Gemara asks, "What exactly is avak lashon hara?" This is not—I don't believe this is an exact quote of the Gemara. It's a bit of a paraphrase, but the idea is as follows: "Could go to Amar." For example, when somebody says, "Hecha mishtakach nura ela beplanya," say that somebody. Where can you find wood or fire? Somebody always has fire in his house to cook. Only in this person's house. Meaning, they sort of say something which seems like it's nice about a person, but at the end could cause other people to start speaking negatively about the person as well. As the Gemara continues, Oshia Sabra Tovasu with Nei Sonav. Another example is where you say something good about a person in front of people that don't like him. Both of these cases are cases where potentially something nice could cause negative things, lashon hara, to be said as a consequence of that. So all of these types of cases are included in avak lashon hara. This is kimat impossible for all of us, including myself, to really, really be careful about, to say every single time you say something nice about a person, that's really potentially a problem of avak lashon hara. Again, our point here is not to discuss the details of avak lashon hara. The point is to realize that lashon hara is a very, very serious sin, and it's so common, it happens all the time in different forms. The chol keyotzei b'zeh, all these kinds of cases. Even though it seems like it's very far away from the regular sin of rechilus, really it's considered to be a minor subcategory of that. And this is the key point. The main point is as follows. The Yetzer has many different ways of attacking us. Anything which could cause nezek, damage or embarrassment to your friend, whether in front of him or not in front of him. This is included in Lashon Hara. Which is hated and disgusted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As the Gemara says, in Erechin kol masaver lashon hara ki'ilu kofer be'ikra. Anybody who tells lashon hara, it's as if he basically has denied the existence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gemara quotes a pasuk here. So again, this is just to sort of clue us in, as we already know, but just to remind us of some of the severity of the sin of lashon hara, bein adam l'chaveiro. And as we'll see, as we go on in this shir, this also has some relevance to the issue of whistleblowing and reporting others to the law in terms of lashon hara, which we'll get to. Okay. Let's begin here. What I think we're going to do is divide it as follows. We're going to divide the first three in the scenarios, the first three, A, B, and C, will be one section of the shiur. That'll be part one. And D will be section two. A, B, and C essentially have to do with the topic of whistleblowing and reporting offenders in general, the general workforce. And D has to do specifically with reporting a Jew, which involves a lot more possibly serious isurim of Mesira. So that'll be the second part of the shiur. Let's start with A, B, and C from the beginning. The basic question that we're talking about here is there an obligation? Is there, maybe not an obligation, but permission? It's mutter, or is it forbidden to what we call, again, blowing the whistle? I didn't write the definition here, but Phil sent me this before. I forgot exactly what it said, but one term, the way that the term blowing the whistle is used is essentially if you report something in your company to the media or the authorities outside the company, meaning external.
So it's like going outside the normal...
Right, going outside the normal channels of what you're supposed to do of reporting something. So we're not going to keep that definition. Our general topic here is broader than that. Our topic is anytime that you see something going wrong, that somebody's doing something they should not be doing, either in the company or we'll see cheating on taxes, any of these types of violations, what are you supposed to do? Should you report them? Are you allowed to report them? Does it matter based on what the violation is all about? That's essentially the case. And if you should report them, how should you report them? Should you talk to a supervisor? Should you go above the supervisor? Does it depend if the supervisor is the one that's violating the offense, right? And from then, should you go to somewhere else, to the law authorities, et cetera, et cetera? That's basically the general question that we have to deal with. And I guess before we go into the details, can anybody figure out what exactly the halachic issues are in this case, this type of situation? What exactly are the halachic issues that we have to discuss? Anybody have any ideas? What are the problems here, or the issues that you would or would not say are recommended?
Breaking contract that may be explicitly
which direction?
Applied with your company.
Which direction? Breaking the contract if you do report it or if you don't report it?
Oh, do report.
Well, there's okay. You have a contract with your company that you might be breaking by violating their procedures. There's a general contract with society that you want to Tikkun HaOlam.
I mean, it's confidentiality they're breaking. You're breaching.
If it's a safety issue, like some of the examples given here, it's potentially because of that.
Good. Excellent. So we'll get to that in just a couple of minutes. In terms of the contract, so the contract is really going to depend on the individual case, as we'll see here, or we'll see a little later on that sometimes the conditions of the company, and this I believe in America at least, specifically for bankers, maybe others as well, have a specific obligation. They absolutely must report anything that they find, and if they don't report it in terms of their clients and in their company, if they don't report any money laundering or other things like that, they're treated as severely as if they actually committed the offense themselves. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's, I believe, what I saw. Yeah, I mean, in the U.S. at least.
Like, if you're in a situation where you have some sort of confidential information which you know potentially should be reported to somebody, kind of like, in a sense, acting as a judge yourself.
Okay.
How do you start? Like, do you go and speak to someone in private, or...
Excellent. Okay, good. So that's going to be part of the question. What's the order of events? And that's related to what we spoke about before, essentially an issue of Lashon Hara. Meaning in this case, confidentiality, which we spoke about a couple weeks ago, directly relates to the issue of Lashon Hara, which we mentioned, whatever it was, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we'll review it again today in this context. When are you allowed to violate the issue of Lashon Hara that we mentioned just a few minutes ago in order to report on somebody else? And what method and order is there to that? That's good. That's one important part of it.
What is the relevance of the laws which are obviously, when you're thinking about whistleblowing, which are broken, what's their relevance according to us? Should we judge the laws? Should we say, Dina de Malchuta Dina?
Good. Excellent. So that's another important point. Very good. That Dina de Malchuta Dina obviously also is going to play a role here. Again, we can take that a number of different directions, which we're not going to have time to take it in all those directions tonight, but just one direction, as I just mentioned before, is the case where the person breaks the law. You see that and you have an obligation according to the law, or at least according to the contract of your company, which, again, is not exactly Dina de Malchuta Dina, but let's assume that they're equatable for now. You have an obligation to report that. So does that mean that you then, based on Dina de Malchuta Dina or based on your contract, you are obligated to report something that you found? Or the other direction, what's going to happen if, let's say, you're going to get fired? That we'll discuss also. Are you obligated according to whatever standards of conduct you have to follow to possibly lose your job if you're reporting against the company and the company decides, well, we don't want this guy here. Yes, he might be reporting something which he should be reporting, but he's not going to be part of our company much longer if he reports that. So that's another question that we have to deal with. Yeah.
For example, there's like standard practice in the industry, let's say whatever, it's accounting or whatever, which is a practice which might not necessarily seem so ethical to someone outside the industry, but it's accepted within the industry.
So that's a good question. The general rule, this is a general rule that will not, it might be different in specific situations.
British MPs, for example.
What'd you say?
British MPs and the expenses.
Yeah. Oh, okay. We spoke about this a previous week, right?
It's all okay.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah. We don't know for sure. Okay, that'll come up also here if you don't know for sure what happens. So that also, right, that also could be a factor, and that's a good question. I think at the end of the day, it's mostly going to depend on the industry, what's considered to be standard practice in that industry. But again, there could be exceptions to that rule.
Even though it might be against the rule?
So it depends. That goes back into last week's share about Dina de Malchus Adina. If it's Dina de Malchus Adina, something that most people don't keep, but if the government is makbid about, they'll catch people, then I don't know. I'm not sure based on what we said last week that necessarily would be okay. If it's something that the government knows people do and the government chooses to sort of ignore, and yes, they'll tell you that's the law, but at the end of the day, they're not going to get anybody for it, then if that's the common practice in the industry, then it might be okay. Depending on what it is. Again, assuming it doesn't violate other laws we discussed last week about reporting taxes, Gneva Stas and Sheker. Again, you have to take each case individually.
Is there an Indian of Lashem as well, potentially, as well?
Okay, yeah, that could be, though, again, every case is going to depend on exactly which direction you're going here. Usually the Chil Hashem would not be in reporting a violation. Usually, second?
If you're the one you got reported on.
Right, 100%, but that's not the question here.
What
yeah.
The person who's doing it is a from Jew, and you know
oh, okay, good. So that's a good question. That's going to get more into the second part in terms of Misira. Misira, yeah, there might be issues of Chil Hashem in the second section. We'll come back to that in part two. Okay, let's go on here. I just wanted to give you just a bit of a flavor of some of the issues. Essentially, what I'm going to do here over the next couple of minutes is follow the outline that Rabbi Levine uses here. Right, Aaron Levine, in one of his business ethics books called Moral Issues of the Marketplace in Jewish Law. Nice, very, very interesting book. So he has a whole chapter on whistleblowing here. I'm going to follow his outline, which means we'll discuss most of these cases. We won't get to all the details, but again, you'll get a good sense of some of the issues that come to play in some of the situations. Let's start with cases case A, which is case one and two in section A. In case one, so we have this company Hughes was using imported microelectronic parts that were untested. These parts were then used in military applications such as F-16 jets. Two supervisors sued their own company for defrauding the taxpayers. They won the case, but were soon fired. Case two, the Challenger disaster. It seems that the external company that made the O-rings reported that they may have problems below a certain temperature. On the day of the launch, the CEO of that company was pressured into revising that statement, saying they were just fine at low temperatures. This actually, Rabbi Levine has this example also in his book here, and he actually elaborates about it a little more, which we're not going to go into now. But basically, he discusses exactly what happens, that the management people wanted to do the launch. They were pressing for the company that made these parts of this part of the shuttle to okay the launch, even though the company, the structural experts and the engineering experts in the company felt very strongly that this was very dangerous to launch below, I think the temperature that day was 18 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, I don't know what is Celsius, minus 10? I don't know, minus 15, whatever it is. So that was a big, big problem, and unfortunately we all know what happened there. So afterwards, basically, the problem was that one of the people in the company wanted to report on the rest of his company, saying, "I strongly said that we shouldn't launch the shuttle, and yet I was overruled by NASA and by people in my company based on other factors that had nothing to do with safety." And the company wanted to fire him. Eventually, I think they took him back. So these questions, what are the obligations, and how do we evaluate what these company officials did when they reported on their own companies? So in this situation, yeah.
Did the person after the disaster speaking, or what the CEO did before?
Good question. I think that we probably would say that it doesn't matter, because even if it was done afterwards, it would have very important consequences in the future, potentially. The next time this happens, you want to make sure that they do things right.
Do the explosion was enough.
The explosion was enough, yes. The explosion was enough.
You don't want the OS to happen again.
Right, I mean, that's the point. The reason why it's important they figure out what happens is that they shouldn't, God forbid, have another tragedy like that the next time. That's why I think it would be important if you didn't have that situation, if you knew for sure that everything was fixed and it didn't matter what was done wrong, I could see that maybe in that case we would say that that there's nothing to be gained by reporting. I could see that. I could see that. That's a question which we're not going to go into now, but I could see that maybe that would be different.
Even in such a case, reporting is a deterrent against other people hiding things. 100%.
100%. Okay, good point. Good point. Good point. Okay, I hear that. I hear that also. Good point. Good point.
We also have the question on this. The engineering team the whole time said there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And when they found out that the CEO okayed the launch, what should have they done?
Right. Okay. So let's take that for. We'll start with that point. It's clear that in this case, this is clearly a case of pikuach nefesh. Okay. So pikuach nefesh, certainly, these are the types of situations that everybody will agree. The employees certainly before the disaster, and in case number one, same idea. These microelectronic parts that were untested, certainly in these kinds of cases where it's potentially dangerous, certainly would have an obligation to report. Let me just take you through Ariel Levine's outline here quickly, and then we can discuss some more questions that have to do with this. The first question that Ariel Levine discusses, which I think is important to discuss, you can turn the side now. We'll look at some of the sources. The first one is a question of tochacha. Now, we're not going to get into all the details of tochacha now, and certainly this will not apply in every situation. But the way Ariel Levine presents this, and I think this makes sense, the first step that the officials should have taken, if possible, were to rebuke the people that were committing the violations of the offenses. So we have a famous pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, Lo sisnos achicha b'levecha, you shouldn't hate your brother in your heart. We'll not discuss now what exactly the details of that pasuk mean, that verse, that phrase mean. Hocheach tochiach es amisecha v'lo sisa olav chet. What you should do is you should rebuke your amisecha, your fellow neighbor, and lo tisa olav chet, you should not bear a sin for him. Now, that phrase also is ambiguous, the Mefarshim grapple with exactly what that means. For us now, the point here is tochacha. There is clearly a mitzvah of tochacha. The Gemara discusses exactly how far the mitzvah of tochacha goes. In source number two, we're not going to read the whole thing inside, but the context here is a question of not adding on Tosefas Yom HaKippur. You're supposed to, there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to add on extra time to Yom Kippur. And the question is, for those that don't do it, should you be telling them to add on the extra couple minutes if they don't do it? And the answer is Mutav Yushogin Valu Mezidin. That's in line two. In source number two, that's what we say. It's better for them to be unintentionally violating it than to be intentionally violating it. If you know that they will not, that they're not going to listen. Then the Ramah adds that only applies for something which is not mefurash b'Torah, which is something which is not explicit in the Torah. But if it's explicit in the Torah, then you have to rebuke. Then you have to protest. So again, without getting into all the details, basically it goes like this. Any case which is not mefurash b'Torah, which is not explicit in the Torah, there is a chiyuv of tochacha if there is a chance that the person might listen. If you know that the person will not listen, then it seems to be better that you should not rebuke them. And again, there was lots of discussion about this.
Tochacha towards a Jewish individual.
Good, so that's, I wanted to get to that in just a second. I was wondering about this also. We'll come back to that after we finish the point about tochacha. But yes, the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, based on the Gemara, is definitely talking about the tochacha to Jews here. And the last part of the Ramah is that, the second to last line, if you know that that your words will not be listened to, now we're talking about something which is explicit in the Torah, a clear d'oraisa. Don't rebuke them in public, rak pam achas. Only do it once. You cannot rebuke him more than once in public for a mitzvah d'oraisa, if you know they will not listen. Famous line here from the Ramah based on the Ran. Individually, in private, you should rebuke him until he hits you or curses you, if we're talking about an explicit mitzvah in the Torah, a clear mitzvah d'oraisa. So that's the rule of the Ramah. However, the Be'er Halacha and other poskim, other achronim, sort of limit this. In a case where, I'll phrase it, this is not the way they phrase it, but I'll phrase it, that more harm is going to be done than good. Meaning at the end of the day, basically, they're not just going to be hitting you or cursing you, they're going to be basically hating you as a Jew and could cause other potential consequences to other Jews. Then certainly in that case, according to many poskim, you would say that it's a better idea not to rebuke the person. So at the end of the day, basically what we have is any mitzvah which is not explicit in the Torah, There is a mitzvah of tochacha, but if you know they will not listen, then you don't have to do it. For a mitzvah d'oraisa, which is explicit, then you should, and you should keep doing it until they hit you, unless you know that things are that's going to cause more harm than good. Say again. So I think the Gemara sounds like it's bichlal here. I think that's what it sounded like in the Gemara. That's a good question. If you want to defend yourself, maybe yes. But there are other issues also. Okay, so that's not our topic now. We're not going to get into this now. The reason that we bring this in is essentially that this would be the first step that the employee should resort to here, that he should engage in tochacha in warning the other person that to stop doing what he's doing. Now, does the obligation of tochacha apply, if you're a Jew, apply to a non-Jewish coworker? That's a question. It's not so clear. And the Gemara's in the post-it, they don't really talk about tochacha for a non-Jew, and there are perhaps reasons why you would say that it does not apply to a non-Jew. In terms of the second, good. Yes, that would be. It actually doesn't say achicha; it says amisecha. But so the truth is, the Gemara elsewhere uses amisecha in a different context to exclude goyim. That goyim, in terms of how goyim get acquire things from a Jew. So it says o kanomi ad amisecha. That's the method of kinyan d'oraisa is different for a Jew than for a non-Jew, and that's derived also from the word amisecha, implying amisecha only a Jew and not a non-Jew. So it could be that also is a good proof that tochacha does not apply for to a non-Jew, meaning that for a Jew to rebuke a non-Jew is not necessarily going to be something that they have to do. And again, there are other reasons also why not, because it could be that the mitzvah for the non-Jew to not keep the law is also not something which is so clear. The non-Jewish society has an obligation to establish court systems and dinim. But again, we discussed this last week. Does that mean that every single non-Jew has an absolute obligation or prohibition of going against the law according to the Torah as well? And he would be subject to tochacha. Again, that's not so clear. So Reb Levine does not discuss that issue at all. He doesn't discuss non-Jews. Certainly, I would say that even if it's not a halacha, it's still definitely a good idea to start, if you think that he might listen, to start with talking to the person directly. Now, how many times will the person listen to you? I don't know. Any of you have had experience with this? Is it actually possible the person would listen to you if you told them that maybe he's doing something wrong and he should stop?
If you followed up with saying, and if not, then...
I'll tell your supervisor. Or I'll go over your head if you're the supervisor.
You'd be fired before you get here.
Okay, good. So we'll get back to the being fired in just a second.
Actually warning the employee itself could in some scenarios be a breach of regulations. There might be a policy that if you find someone, money laundering is a very good example. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that will come back to
you get hit with probably more than
good.
He would.
Okay, good point. Let me take a second to focus on Micah's point for just a second here, because I don't want to discuss it later, but we'll discuss it now. If you jump to letter D in the scenarios, we're not going to do the whole thing now, because it's about the Jew, but the point that I want to get out of this for right now is where it says in the case here, that's under the law in the UK, an accountant or lawyer has to report any suspicion of money laundering or use of crime proceeds to the authorities, and he is not, N-O-T, not allowed to inform that person. It is a criminal offense to warn them. So we'll stop there. The rest of it is discussing a Jewish client.
It's a criminal offense also not to report them.
Okay, good. So that will come to later, and we'll discuss the non-Jewish aspect of that right now. Just in terms of the point that Micah was making, so in this case, it sounds like you're not allowed, at least according to the UK laws, you're not allowed to inform the person. According to that, if that's the law, so if we accept, based on last week, if we accept the rules of Dina de Malchus Adina as being binding in these types of situations, then what you probably would say here is that you shouldn't warn them. Certainly if there's not a mitzvah of tochacha, but maybe even if there is, maybe even if there is, since the whole violation here is not a Bina Makam, it's not an Isra Veheter type issue, it's a Dina Mamanos type issue.
The whole idea of tochacha is that you're seeing somebody either engaging in something and you want him to stop,
right?
Or perhaps he's done something that he can reverse,
right?
But in such a case, you can't. You know, he's already committed himself. It's not like you're watching him steal money from a bank. You caught the evidence after the case. So would tochacha even apply here? It's not. You're looking
it's
at that. Yeah, it's done. Yeah.
If it's done already, then you're probably right. Right. That's a good point. Again, maybe you have an obligation to give him tochacha that he shouldn't do it in the future. Meaning, if there would be an obligation of tochacha, maybe it would still apply in terms of doing it in the future. But you're absolutely right. Rabbi Levine says this as well, that the bottom line is that all these kinds of situations, tochacha is not the most important factor. It is a factor to consider. And if that were an option to get him to stop in some types of situations, I'll just give a better, more down-to-earth example, which maybe we'll discuss next week. We're going to talk about questions of idling during work time or taking other things from work. So if your coworker is using office supplies that he's not supposed to. That's already something, fine, he did it already, but you know he's going to do exactly the same thing again tomorrow. That's already something which maybe there is room to say that maybe perhaps there's either maybe not an obligation of tochacha, but some elements of perhaps telling him something that maybe it's a good idea that he should stop, even if it's not a mitzvah. But that would be maybe a better case. Let's go into the more central issues here for these types of situations. And those are, A, lo tamar al dam riacha. What'd you say? We'll get back to that in a second. Lo tamar al dam riacha and lashon hara. So lo tamar al dam riacha, I did not put this on the source sheet here, but actually, I'm sorry, I did put it on the source sheet. Source number 4. There's two categories here of lo tamar al dam riacha, which we'll discuss right now. This is from the Sifra. The second part of the Sifra, we'll get to it in a second, is also in the Gemara. The Sifra says, "Uminayin shemata yodea lo edus einata rashai lishtok alea." How do we know that if you know testimony about a person, presumably against him here, I think that's the context in the Sifra, how do we know that you're not allowed to be silent? You have to give the testimony. Tam lomar lo samar al dam riacha. Now, there are other issues also in terms of holding back testimony, which we're not going to get into now. But in the Sifra here, the Sifra says that's also a violation of lo samar al dam riacha. It's something that that you could help. Again, the situation is not clear exactly what it is, but presumably it involves some sort of monetary issues where somebody could stand to lose a lot of money if you don't testify either in defense or against him or somebody else. That's a violation of lo samar al dam riacha. That we'll come back to in a minute.
Yeah. Said it's monetary?
So that's what it seems to be. We'll come back to that in a minute. I want to do the Pikuach Nefesh part first, which is the second part of the Sifra. How do we know that if you see somebody drowning in the river or robbers coming to rob him, or a wild animal coming to attack him, that you have to save him. You got to save his life. You cannot stand idly by when the blood of your friend is about to be spilled. So that is the part, the second part there is also in the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Ein Gimel. That is the part where we clearly see that there is a mitzvah of Hatzalas Nefashos. If you have the opportunity to help save somebody's life, you have an absolute mitzvah obligation to do that.
Save somebody's or your fellow Jew?
Good question. Okay, good question. Let's get the main point down and we'll come back to that. What'd you say?
But not by putting iron on.
So that's another question, also a good point, which we don't have time to get into tonight. All right. John, your point first. When it comes to endangering your own life in order to save somebody else, this is a major, major machlokas in the Rishonim and in the Poskim. It's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch and Siman, I think, Tav Chav Vav. At the end of the day, I think we paskin that you are not obligated to put your own life in danger in order to save somebody else. However, if there's a question that it's not so clear your life will be in danger, it's what we call suffix sakana, that maybe your life will be in danger. That's also a big debate, which we're not going to get into now. But the definite chiyuv of lo samar al dam riacha applies when your life will not definitely be in danger, and maybe will not be in danger at all. It's something that let's say you're the lifeguard. You know how to swim, right? So somebody's drowning in the sea, God forbid, at the beach. So if you're the lifeguard, that's your job. And maybe even if you're not, but you know how to swim well, you can do this without too much danger to your own life, then you know, presumably a reasonable risk you would be obligated to take. Again, obviously, there's a risk anytime you go swimming in the ocean. But the point is, if you know what you're doing, so you should go save the person. That's a clear case of saving for pikuach nefesh. So in terms of the principle, clearly, lo samar al dam riacha and the scenarios for case 1 and case 2 where there was possible sakanas nefashos, we would say that certainly the people should do have an obligation to try to report. Okay, we're not done. Give me another minute and we'll finish up. One or two other points first before we finish up this case. In B, we'll do it like this. We'll do B first, the monetary loss, and then we'll come back to the question of the non-Jew. And then the question of whether you might lose your job. Okay, that'll be the order here. In case B, all right, in another Medicaid case involving Smith, GlaxoSmithKline, and a whistleblower, in which a man named Marina, what is it?
Glaxo?
Okay. All right, I apologize. It's for Lashon Hara purpose, with confidentiality. I want to keep his name. But he figured out who he was anyway. So the man named Marina, okay, whatever it is, blew the whistle on fraudulent laboratory billing practices. The Department of Justice received $333 million. After a 7-day evidentiary hearing to determine the relator's share, Mr. Marino was awarded $52 million and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, and change.
Settled for the 52.
Yeah, it settled for the 52. Okay. So do you want to explain this case a little more, just for, I also was a little bit unclear here exactly.
So I was actually just pulling this this case from a list of, there was a bunch of lists of cases saying that the whistleblower can get money out of blowing the whistle, like to give some incentive to it. There's a law in the States where the whistleblower can get something like up to 25% of the damages. So they sue, and the government joins in the suit with them, and then they win, and the government gets most of the money.
And the whistleblower's lawyer can get 10% of
But you see, in a case like this, he gets 52, the lawyer takes half, he still doesn't have to work anymore, which he's probably not going to be able to work anymore.
Right. So. Right, that's part of the reason why they get the money, probably, is in order to prepare them for the fact that they're about to get fired. Okay, you sell it for that. I would also, $52 million. Okay, so the question is here also, is this the type of situation where we would say that you are obligated or allowed even to blow the whistle on this type of activity?
That could be blowing the whistle for the money as opposed to helping.
That's a good question. That we will. It's actually, even though I don't know
what
if you
your
mentioned.
Intention
is it? Is that a serious question or a serious question? Okay, so it's a good question, and we'll come back to that also in a minute. That comes to the question of lashon hara. This is clearly lashon hara to blow the whistle in these types of situations. The question is, when is it mutter to tell lashon hara? And part of the answer will be that it might depend on your intentions. That'll be source number five, which we'll get to in just a minute. Before we get to the issues of lashon hara, just in terms of understanding lo samad al dam riacha, so as we mentioned before in the medrash in the sifra, so the first case in the sifra, at least the way that it's understood by the Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer Chafetz Chaim, as well as a number of other achronim, is that the case where you know testimony about somebody else that you need to testify is talking about a case where if you don't testify, somebody else could potentially lose a lot of money, and therefore, according to this, what we seem to be saying is that the mitzvah of lo samad al dam riacha, that you have to come to somebody else's aid to help somebody, that applies even if we're not talking about a potential sakonas nefashos, loss of life, but even if we're talking about potential loss of money. That's the way the Chafetz Chaim understands this sifra. A number of other achronim as well, the Minchas Chinuch, I think, might have been understood this way. The Chavos Yair, Rav Yair Bachrach, one of the Shailos HaTshuvos, quoted in the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Waldenberg, also seem to accept this approach. A number of other poskim also accept this approach, that any time that somebody might lose money and you can help them, you have an obligation to help them. So therefore, according to this...
Even if they're not Jewish.
So one second, we didn't get there yet. I told you there was an order here. Okay, that's the next step. Lo samad al dam riacha, at least for Jews for now, seems to apply even in a situation where they might lose money. According to that, it would seem to follow that you would have an obligation, according to the Torah, to inform on other people if their actions are causing other people or community or the society at large to potential losses, whatever those types of losses might be. That would seem to follow from this sifra. Now again, there's two questions we have to discuss here. That's the question of the non-Jews and also the question of, is there a limit? So does this apply to goyim? Meaning, is there a mitzvah of lo samad al dam riacha for goyim? Anybody know? Meaning that you have an obligation to save goyim.
Either us or neither of
them. Either anything. Again, I don't want to get into too many of the details here, but good. So we're not going to get into that in detail, but that is, David's absolutely right, that there's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah which discusses certain types of people which are frowned on by Jewish tradition. Certain kinds of people that were considered to not be the best types of people. Roi Bakar, people that were certain kinds of shepherds, people that were Ovid Avodah Zarah, that were idol worshippers. Other types of perhaps non-Jews also were included, that maybe you don't, if they fall into a pit, maybe you're not supposed to help them back up again. Apparently, according to the Gemara, it sounds like non-Jews, certainly Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and perhaps all non-Jews are not included in the mitzvah of Lo Samad al Dam Riacha, that you have an obligation to save them if they are crying out from the pit, help me, help me, help me, or from the ship, right? They're drowning. You might not have an obligation to save them. That's what it... Second?
Ava.
One second. Give me a second. That's what the Gemara sounds like, and the Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat in Siman Tuf Chaf Hey, I think it is, appears to Paskin like that. However, there are one or two limitations to that rule, even within Goyim. Number one, there may be an issue of Eva, absolutely, that if it's going to cause a hatred and enmity among the non-Jewish population, absolutely, there might be still a mitzvah of some sort to save them. And number two, more fundamentally, the Meiri and a number of others, including the Be'er HaGola, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, in that Siman and Tav Chaf Hei, suggest that the Goyim today's non-Jews are not the same thing as same status as non-Jews previously. The previous non-Jews that were idol worshippers were barbaric. They were not normal civilized people, and therefore we could understand why people like that would not have been included in this mitzvah. People today that we, again, there might be people that don't like the Jews, but in general, most societies are somewhat more just and civilized than they used to be, and therefore, according to the Be'er HaGolah, the Me'iri, and a number of others, we would say that the mitzvah, certainly the mitzvah of trying to save their life, if you have the opportunity, would indeed apply, and that's what Rabbi Levine, I think Rabbi Levine implicitly assumes that. He doesn't come out and say it straight out, but implicitly, I believe that he assumes that, and I know a number of my other Rabbanim as well would assume that the same idea, that when it comes to saving a non-Jewish life, certainly that would apply, and presumably here also, if you're talking about preventing monetary damage to other people in society that are not Jewish, the same thing would also apply.
Even against the
Jew. I don't worry about that.
It depends what's involved. What's happening to the Jew? Are you informing on the Jew in order to save the non-Jew? So that's going to be, that will come back to in section D. Okay, that will come back to.
No, it's not whistleblowing. The lawsuit is ongoing. There's everything, and
okay.
I've got a piece of information
right.
which could help the non-Jew in the lawsuit.
Understood. So if that's going to indirectly cause the Jew to
but
to go to jail.
No, not jail.
Okay.
Something, damages, whatever, money,
right.
who has to
right.
pay something.
Right.
$1 million, they'll either be awarded to the non-Jew or to the Jew. They're in the...
If
you're a witness,
crash.
You could be
right.
a witness for defense for the guy.
Say you're a witness in a car crash and a Jew
you
want
to testify.
Okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. Would you say?
If you see a car crash, you see a Jew has gone into the back of a non-Jew.
Right.
You're the witness.
Okay, good. So again, in that type of situation, if we're not talking about incriminating the Jew that he's going to be sent to jail or something like that, I think you would say that perhaps the rules of Dina de Machlus Adina apply, and therefore even if the Jew is going to have to pay a fine of some sort or he's going to get, whatever the case is, it could be that in Achanam, you would have some sort of obligation to help the non-Jew. But again, Dina de Machlus Adina, I guess we'll put it this way. I think you would be allowed to help the non-Jew in that situation.
Didn't we learn on the second law, you know, the idea that in front of the court you can't bear force, you can't give...
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody's talking about lying here. That's not at all what we're referring to. What we mean is that if you have certain things that you could provide...
But an omission is also...
No, I could not.
That's not lying. That doesn't mean that it's right, but it's not lying. Omission is not lying.
I could not go to court.
Right, that's the case.
Maybe you wouldn't go to court. I have evidence has to be...
Except in Vermont.
Would they? Except for?
I think Vermont has a good Samaritan law. But besides that, the United States.
Okay. You're not obligated to go to court. Right. Okay, I think that's what I understood as well. Yeah.
So
I
had a guest a few years ago. I was going in the evening from work. I was at a station and I saw there was a guy and he was being beaten up by about four other guys.
Yeah. Who are the Jews?
None of them.
Okay.
They were clearly all not Jewish.
Okay. Baruch Hashem. Right? Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem.
I'm judging by their skin color. But I asked my rabbi afterwards, I said, do I have any obligation to get involved at all? And I was very surprised. He turned around and said, actually, yes. He said, would it have been for Kirkman? I said, probably not. Because then probably you should have got involved.
So that l'chora, that would be based on this type of situation here. That if you could potentially help one of them,
diving in and try and get, probably
right.
getting beaten up
right.
as well.
Right. Right. So again, I would be scared.
He's being beaten up by three other black guys.
Right. I would be scared to get involved there because you never know what they might do to you if you somehow get involved, even if it's afterwards. Right. I would be scared to be involved based on personal. Personal safety concerns. But,
it's a difficult case.
If you accept that those goyim are included in the cases of the goyim of the Gemara, then maybe. Right. Understood. If there was no issues of safety concerns, I could definitely see that based on what we're saying, and
you
apparently agreed that if you can help, then maybe you have an obligation to help one another.
Okay.
Right, so that's good.
So
that's good enough. That's good. If they get you afterwards and they want you to come and talk about it more, so you'll follow with whatever they tell you to do. Okay. Interesting case. Okay, very good. So the case of the Jew and the non-Jew is a little bit more unclear. I think you would say there also, as long as that there might be a mitzvah to help the non-Jew also if it's like a traffic case, and you can help define who was at fault and what happens afterwards. There definitely might be room to say that you can get involved, but that I could see that maybe there's another side also. I would have to look a little more carefully to see if there's other makoros that focus on that issue directly. Okay, next point. What's going to happen Actually, there's two more points first, and then we'll go to this scenario D. What happens if you, put it this way, if we say that you're violating Lashon Hara, okay? Is there a problem of violating Lashon Hara in any of these scenarios? So the answer is that there's not necessarily a problem of Lashon Hara as long as certain conditions are fulfilled.
You said that in order to get someone money which he deserves, you're allowed to do a testimony.
To get, yeah. Okay.
So
yeah.
A case of whistleblowing.
Yeah.
Where there's a certain percentage of money to the whistleblower.
Right.
Why can't I give the testimony to save myself that money? Why can't I be as if I were two people to save myself getting those $52 million? I have to be a whistleblower and give the information.
You're not saving yourself. You're earning for yourself.
Doesn't matter. It's a testimony which can allow me to get those $52 million.
Not to save money that had been yours.
What'll be the problem with that?
What'll
be the problem with that?
Regardless, there's no
big question. There's never. I don't think there's ever going to be a problem in testifying in some situation which might happen to help you as long as your testimony is accurate. The only question is the Lashon Hara aspect. The only question is going to be the Lashon Hara aspect in the Chofetz Chaim, source number 5. Say again?
That you have any time to testify.
Correct. I'm just saying, well, let's just briefly look at the column of Lashon Hara.
I think it's fine, because the reality is that of the $52 million, probably 70% went to the lawyer, so that's getting money.
It's very possible. Very possible. I hear.
Especially if the lawyer's Jewish.
Coming from a Jewish lawyer. Coming from a Jewish lawyer. Okay. Okay, let's just go on here. In source number 5, so the Chofetz Chaim puts certain conditions, which I think we've seen in the past already, about Lashon Hara. We'll read them very quickly. The Chofetz Chaim says here, Im echad roeh shechaver rotel lishtatef eza davar im echad, v'hu mishaer shebevaday yisavev lo aydei zeh inyan ra. If you see somebody who wants to do something with somebody else, and you know that it's going to cause him something bad to happen to him, tzorech lahagid lo kedei lahatzilo min ha'inyan harahu. You got to tell him to save him from whatever... from that whatever bad occurrence might happen afterwards. Ach tzorech lazach chamisha pratim. But there's 5 conditions for telling him. What does he mean here? What he means to say is that you would have to tell the person who's getting involved lashon hara about the other person. You would say to A, well, you know, if you're doing something with B, you should realize that B is somebody who breaks the law all the time, and he's probably getting you involved in something illegal. That's what we're talking about here. That type of scenario where you're going to tell lashon hara to A in order to save A from what B might do. However, there are conditions. Aleph, Yizahir Ma'od, Shaliach Lit Tekaf Es Inyan B'datol Inyan Ra. Vakis Bonin Hetev Mitzchilo. Key. You got to think about it first. Don't jump the gun and say something right away. Make sure you think about exactly what you're going to say. Imhu Be'etzem Ra. Is it really bad? Meaning, you have to know that it's something negative first, and whether it's necessary, think about it. That's really the bottom line. Beit, Shaliach Agdil B'Sipuro Es Inyan La'ra Yoser Mimashu. Don't exaggerate. You have to tell the story as it is. A major problem with talking to the media when stories get leaked to the media is that sometimes these kinds of stories, the media couldn't care less what the actual documents say, and they'll run and write something in the paper which is totally false or ignore what the actual evidence is. Be very, very careful when you tell Lashon Hara that you are not exaggerating the story. Gimel, Shechavein Rach L'Toelis. Another very, very important point you have to have, and this maybe speaks to your case perhaps, that you have to have the benefit of the person in mind. You're trying to remove the potential damage to the person from this. Not because you hate the other person, that you want to get the other person in trouble. Rather, you want to help the person that is potentially getting himself in trouble. The person that's going to lose out, you want to help him. Now, what if you just want to get money for yourself? So I could hear that maybe that's okay. I mean, the main point here is that you don't want to ruin somebody else, that you don't hate somebody else. But okay, that's that could be a question. If you can potentially get across your point here to save the other person from harm without telling the Lashon Hara, then you should not tell it. And hey, again, that's also an important point. You have to make sure that this is the only method, the whistleblowing, we'll call it, is the only method of accomplishing your goal of saving somebody else or other of the society. There's no other way around it. And hey, kol ze eino mutzer rak im lo yisavev al yidei asipor ra mamish lednidon. This is only not mutzer if you're not going to cause ra'a mamish, literal evil, lanidon, to the person, meaning something really, really bad to the person who's being judged. Dehaino shel yiru imo mamish, that the person that you're whistleblowing on should not, something really bad should not happen to him. He shouldn't get beaten up or something else like that. Rakshet tusar mimenu al yidei ze hatova. All that happens there is that nothing good is going to, meaning that the good part is taken out of him, shaya osei moha shekenegdo, that the other person will do. After me, meila davar zehu ra'alo, even though really it's bad, he thinks it's good, etc., etc. Mikol makom mutter is mutter, as long as the person that you are trying to get into trouble is not going to have something really, really bad happen to him. Based on the story of the person, the other person that you're talking about, something bad is going to happen to him. Asur l'sa parallel, then you can't say this bad. You need to have other details. And again, this principle is a little bit more complicated, and we're not going to get into the details of this now, but certainly in some situations, I don't know if this principle is going to apply. And we'll discuss the situations in the second section, in the Jewish section, because they apply to Masira as well. Just for example, if you're talking about, God forbid, a child molester or somebody else who's endangering people's, not even their lives, but robbing, other kinds of situations which are a risk to society at large. It could be that even though the person's going to sit in jail, certainly you would be allowed to tell Lashon Hara about him. But for the main thing that we get out of these conditions of the Chofetz Chaim is that there's always a process, there's an order. And if you choose to tell, or if you feel that you must tell others about somebody's illegal activities, there's an order of how to do it. What is that order? Sir Rabbi Willig, in one of his shiur he gave on this topic, basically said, common sense, the order is first you talk to the supervisor, and then if that doesn't work, you threaten to go over his head, etc., 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 in that type of order. If that doesn't work, then you would threaten to go to the authorities. Now, in any of those situations, if you risk losing your job, which unfortunately is a very, very real risk, the question is, are you obligated to lose your job in order to fulfill this mitzvah of Lo Salman Adam Riacha? What do you think the answer is?
It's muffled.
Good answer, but in this case, the answer is probably no. What?
It depends.
Okay, it does depend. You're right, it does depend. The bottom line is probably that the answer is no, that you're not obligated to lose your job for this type of situations, but Yaakov is correct that it is a machlokas. What do I mean? Again, very, very bekitzer, because I want to get to the second section. There's a question in the Rishonim. If you have a mitzvah lo sasa, you have a negative mitzvah, okay, Torah says that you can't violate Shabbos. Now, what happens if, in order to prevent yourself from violating Shabbos, you are going to lose all of your money? You're going to lose your job. Are you obligated to keep the Shabbos if you might lose your job by keeping the Shabbos? The answer is yes. Okay. What the Ramah says, and what many of the Rishonim say, is that any mitzvah lotas, any negative mitzvah, you are obligated to lose all of your money in order to keep that mitzvah. According to that, you might say that in this situation as well, losam l'adam riacha is a negative mitzvah. Perhaps you're obligated to lose all of your money in order to help somebody else. It's what?
Kumbase.
So it depends what the situation is. Meaning, if what we're saying here is that if you don't do anything, you sit silently and you don't help the person, your action is a sheva al tase. Your action is you're being passive. You're doing nothing. Okay, that's what might be the distinction we'll get to in just a second. So 2 points here. Even in the case where there is a question of pikuach nefesh, of causing somebody else's life being in danger, so could be. This is a question. The Chasam Sofer seems to disagree with the Ramah. The Chasam Sofer says that any situation where your violation of the lotase is passive, then perhaps the idea that losing all your money doesn't apply. Meaning what? Just take this example, for instance. In the case of Lo Salman al-Dam Riacha, if you are potentially, if you could save somebody's life, you could help, you could, let's say, blow the whistle and talk about one of these cases here, which there might have been danger involved. But in doing so, you are going to lose your job, you're going to lose your panasa, you're going to lose your livelihood. According to the Chasam Sofer, it could be, again, he doesn't discuss this case directly, but it would follow, according to his rule, that if your violation of Lo Samod Adam Riacha is passive, because you're not doing anything, right? There's no action, you're just sitting there and not reporting something. It could be in that situation that that's okay. Meaning any passive violation of a lotase, like Lo Samod Adam Riacha, would be allowed where the other alternative is that to fulfill the mitzvah, you would lose your entire, you lose all of your money. That's according to the Chasam Sofer, and the Chasam Sofer is actually accepted by many, many poskim against the Ramah in this type of situation. So that's one approach, that perhaps you would not be obligated to lose all of your money in order to whistleblow on somebody else, even if it causes danger.
I have a question. Is losing one's job considered losing all of my money?
I would think the answer is yes, unless you're somebody that has 15 offers that you can get a job the next second in the next company down the block.
It's money that I don't have.
Correct. I mean, it's a good question. My impression would be that unless you know that you can get a job very soon, then that would be considered to be losing all your money. Because, okay, yes, you have money in the bank, but the bottom line is that all your money doesn't mean all your money. It means even 3/4 of your money, let's say, or 2/3 of your money. Your parnasa
more
right
more
now. Your parnasa right now. Yeah, more than a chomesh, right? Your parnasa right now, I think, would be included.
It's the future.
Right. Right. Now,
covered well,
right.
About, like
that's what I would think. Now, if you told me that you're a millionaire, you have $20 million in the bank, and now you're going to lose your parnasa of $2,000 a month, you know, is not that much. Maybe okay, I could hear that. Maybe that's different. Maybe that's not considered to be losing all your money. Maybe that would be included in the rule of a fifth. That to do this kind of mitzvah, you do have to give up a fifth of your money. Meaning, in order to save somebody else, you would have to give up a fifth of your money, even according to the Chasam Sofer, in order to try to save him. Second?
Isn't that only for an asse?
For? Yes, what the Chasam Sofer is saying is that the same rule applies for a lo ta'ase if your violation is passive.
Okay.
Meaning the Ramah is saying, even if it's passive, seems to be you still have an obligation to lose all of your money rather than violate the lo ta'ase. The Chasam Sofer says, no, if it's a passive violation, then all you have to do is give up a fifth, but no more than that. Okay, that's when it comes to questions of pikuach nefesh, that even there might not be, you might not have to lose your job, perhaps. When it comes to cases where it's all about monetary loss, like in the case B we had above, then I think almost everybody would agree that in that situation there's no problem, that you do not have to blow the whistle if blowing the whistle means that you might lose your job. Because there it's your money versus somebody else's money. He's going to lose money or somebody else in society will lose money if you don't blow the whistle, and otherwise you'll lose money. So why is your money any more less precious than his money? In that case, many poskim, including Rabbi Levine, want to say that in that case, certainly, according to everybody, there's no obligation to lose your job in order to help somebody else keep their money. So, unfortunately, because of the rules today, there are protection rules in some places that Rabbi Levine speaks about at length here, in terms of whistleblowers. But the bottom line is, if you know that you might lose, there's a good chance you'll lose your job, you probably do not have to report
them. If I lose how much? I'm just saving someone else's money.
That's a good question.
Money more important than my money.
That's a good question.
If you lose $100.
I think that they would say... Yeah, so it's not clear. So I'm not sure. That's not clear. Rabbi Levine, I think, did not talk about the fifth directly. I have to look again to see exactly what he says here. But he generally had a whole discussion about this. I'm just summarizing for you the bottom line here. I think what he would say is that even if... Rabbi Levine seems to quote here. You can take a look at it yourself afterwards. Page 432. He compares this based on something from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, that this is considered to be similar to Hashavas Aveda, that he wants to say in these kinds of situations, for Hashavas Aveda also, you're not required to lose any money in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, because keeping somebody else's money versus losing your own money is not a situation that the rule of the fifth of a fifth applies to. But I think that's what he's saying here. Again, I have to look at this a little more carefully, but I believe that's what he's saying here.
In the UK, you can't fire a whistleblower.
Second?
In the United Kingdom, you cannot fire a whistleblower.
Okay, so in those situations, perhaps there's the halacha is going to be different. Say again? You would be?
You can be in trouble for it.
Oh, right. So that's a question. Again, what does that mean that you're going to get in trouble?
But they're protected.
Okay, so that's going to be a question. I mean, if it's something that you know you'll be protected from your job, then it could be that in that situation you would have an obligation of lo samal adam riecha, and you should try to blow the whistle. And again, every situation has to be a little different. You have to know in your own situation is what's going to happen to you, what are going to be the consequences of your actions. But if you really are protected, then it stands to reason that you would be obligated to try to inform. Certainly, if that's the law, dina de mechusa dina, we would probably say, according to many poskim, though not maybe not all, but many poskim probably would say that if that's the law that you have to inform, then you have to report it. Okay, very good. Any other questions on that section? Now we'll go to the second section.
What about something more than matzah, I guess, for us?
Okay.
Informing on a Jewish minor. So you see two kids fighting in the playground, can you go to one of the
So again, let's well, the Jews we'll talk about in scenario D. Okay. Mesira is a separate discussion. We'll get to that in just a minute. Any other questions? About any of these kinds of cases. Okay. And again, remember there is an order. So if you know that you won't, that your job is protected, you follow the order. You go start with the supervisor, and then if that doesn't work, go above his head. And then if that doesn't work, then maybe you go to the law authorities. You have to be careful of exactly how you do it. If you know that you could get away with it.
So I don't know whether this sort of overlaps into the next section.
And again, this by the way has to be a case of Luto Ellis. That's just. I didn't think we mentioned before, if you're doing it because you already left the company and you're upset that the company fired you and now you want to report on everything they've done, according to the Chofetz Chaim, that's also, you're not allowed to tell Lashon Hara in that situation. because it's not being done with toelis. It's not for the benefit of society. It's being done because you do not like the company because of what they've done to you. So that you got to be careful about. Sorry. Okay, let's go to scenario D. Three scenarios here. We'll start with the first one, and then we'll go to the second two afterwards. Reporting a Jew to the authorities. Is it permitted to report a Jew to the law enforcement agencies? Are the halachas of reporting Jews the same as the halachas above, that essentially there's a mitzvah of losam al dam riacha? Again, assuming that you won't lose your job or anything, that you would have to report them? Or do we say no, that reporting a Jew is much more severe? Under the law in the UK, as we mentioned before, an accountant or lawyer has to report any suspicion of money laundering or use of crime proceeds to the authorities, and he is not allowed to inform that person. It is a criminal offense to warn them. If I suspect a Jewish client to have laundered money, having seen strange payments appear in his bank statements, which is enough to trigger the UK money laundering rules. That's an important point, by the way, because if you're not sure, we'll discuss, if you're not sure, the halacha is probably that you cannot report in any of these situations. Okay, Rabbi Willig mentioned this also in his shir, that forget the Jew, non-Jew, whoever it is, if you're not sure that they've done something wrong, you probably cannot report, and you probably don't have an obligation to report. Only if you know that they've done something wrong, or if the law is that based on what you have seen, you should report it. In those cases, that's when you would need to report it. Anyway, in this situation, this Jewish client who's possibly laundering money, do I have to report him, or are there reasons why I cannot report a fellow Jew? So what's the answer? Anybody know? Yes, but let's go in order here. According to the Gemara, what's this?
But I think this is... I'd like to hear an answer on it that used a different scenario, because money laundering is just an absolute. If you are in a position as in this scenario here is the UK, but if you're in a position where you suspect someone may have done something or may be contemplating doing something which will lead to the act of money laundering, and you don't report it, you yourself are subject to prosecution, criminally and civilly. So, you know, this could be perhaps a different scenario, a general scenario in another situation where you're aware generally of a non-Jew who's violating some other area of the law, because here the law is absent.
Okay. How common is that in the United States, that you actually, I mentioned the example of the bankers before, but is that common in other areas also in the U.S. or is it just in the U.K.?
No, the attorney kind of privilege would protect the attorney client. I mean, it's absolute. So it wouldn't happen. The accountant, on the other hand, would be a different scenario, but a lawyer would be absolutely privilege, I think, would hold.
Okay. Sayer.
So if a U.S. lawyer is aware that his client is laundering money?
Yeah.
He doesn't have to report it?
As far as I know, I don't think he has to report it.
Because he's trying to defend it.
If the lawyer knows the client's guilty and the client wants to plead not guilty,
so that Yaakov, that we discussed last week. Okay, we're not going to go into that again. If you want, that I can tell you about later if you want, or you can listen to the recording from last week.
By the way, but you're right.
The question in general is an important question. Let's go through some of the makoros very quickly, and then we'll see what we come out with. The basic halacha is that there is an isser of mesira, an isser, a very serious isser drabbanan of mesira, of turning over another Jew to the authorities. And unfortunately, back in the day, this was very, very common for Jews to slander other Jews to the government or to the authorities, or some sort of, not even authorities, but bandits of some sort. And that could cause those Jews that were informed on to be beaten up, to be robbed, to be even put themselves physically in danger. What'd you say? Again, if it really means that they're gonna potentially be killed, then the answer is it might be d'oraisa also. But the direct legislation of the Isser Mesira was enacted by the rabbis. The Torah does not talk about an Isser Mesira. The Rabbanan came up with the Isser Mesira. It appears at the end of Maseches Bava Kamma. I just quoted for you here the Shulchan Aruch, the bottom line in source number 6. You are not allowed to give over a Jew to the hands of non-Jewish, we'll call them aggressors or bandits, anosim. Whether you're giving over his body, meaning himself, that they're going to beat him up, or his money, they're going to rob him. Even if the Jew that you're giving over was a Rasha and a Baal Averos, he did a lot of Averos. Even if the Jew was giving you a hard time. And the Gemara actually has situations like this, where certain Amoraim actually did this, and afterwards they were taken away, and there was a question of whether that was allowed to be done or not. We're not going to go into that now, we don't have time. But the point here is that even if the person's giving you a hard time, you're still not allowed to report those people to the authorities. Why is that? Because, again, as we mentioned, generally speaking, in the Gemara's times, and also after the Gemara's times, it was you never knew what might happen to those Jews that were informed on. Would you say?
It says there to
excellent.
Beat you up or people are going to
excellent.
Steal you.
So
not stealing them, they're not beating
consistently
up.
Very good, Shlomo. Right. So Shlomo has an excellent point here in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shulchan Aruch got this from the Gemara and later sources in the Rishonim. Usually, the word that's used here is not a government; it's anosim. Anosim, as I translated, are what we call aggressors or bandits, people that could be violent. So the question is, does this Isser of Mesir that Chazal enacted, does that also apply to a contemporary society where the government and the law enforcement agencies are just? They are civilized. Or maybe we'd say, no, maybe this Isser does not apply in any situation where you know that the law is going to be fair about what they judge and how they judge you. That is the major, major question, halacha l'mayis, when it comes to Mesira. And the answer here is that it's a machlokas. Okay, this is a very, very, very major machlokas. I will summarize for you briefly some of the major opinions. There are a lot of opinions. We're not going to get to all of them. For this issue, if you're interested, Rabbi Broid from Atlanta has a nice article in the RJJ Journal from spring 2002 called Informing on Others for Violating American Law, a Jewish Law View. It's all about Nasira. Excellent article. And he summarizes a lot of the opinions here, some of which we will not get to tonight. Okay, let's first look at the Igros Moshe. I'm not going to read both of these tshuvas. I don't think we have time. But Rav Moshe has at least two tshuvas that deal at least implicitly with this type of question. The first one, I'm not going to read the first one inside. I'll read the second one inside. The first one is basically when somebody is selling treif and he's claiming that it's kosher, can you report him to the non-Jewish authorities when he says that he's going to listen to the Beis Din? So the answer, Rav Moshe's answer essentially is that if he's going to listen to the Beis Din, then you cannot report him to the non-Jewish authorities. His second reason for that is, he has two reasons. The second reason, which is relevant to us, is that the non-Jewish authorities are going to judge the person Shalom Kedinei Yisrael. And since they're not going to judge him Kedinei Yisrael, then Rav Moshe says we have to be choshish for an Isser of Moser. They're not going to judge him the way that he should be judged according to Halacha, and therefore that is a problem of Mesira. That's where Rav Moshe says in the first case. In source number 9, let me just read source number 9 first, and then you can comment. Ramosh has a second tshuva. Can you accept the position as a tax auditor for the government? That once in a while, you basically find somebody who did something wrong with their taxes, and you're going to have to report them to the government. Is that okay? And the government is going to punish, the IRS will tell the law, to punish you more than the Torah would punish you. What's the halacha? Hanachon lanios daiti, keronz v'etzim harei kol mi sheyi yaroach hashbonos yimtzas hapshia. Rav Moshe says, well, even if you weren't the tax auditor, somebody else is going to be doing that job, right? The job market is very competitive. Ubarer sha'af imzeh lo yirtzeh lekabel mishrazu, and certainly even if you didn't take the job, mi'am emshala from the government, yi yasham roach hashbonos, there'll be somebody else. V'nimtzah shelo yafzer haposhea yoser kishu yikabel hamishra, yikishelo yikabel hu. So the person that you might potentially report is not going to lose any more money or less money if you're there or somebody else is there doing the same job. Therefore, you are not, according to Rav Moshe, you are not damaging him directly because he's going to be damaged by the law enforcement agencies if you happen to have this job. So you did the job of finding his cheating on taxes and reporting him. But if it wasn't you, it would have been somebody else. And therefore, Rav Moshe thinks in this context, again, it doesn't apply in every context, but in this context, Rav Moshe believes that there's no problem of Isser. It's not your direct damage to this person. And he compares it to a Gemara in Bava Kama, which we don't have time to get into now, which I dotted there. He has another point here that their main job is not to discover people's mistakes or not mistakes, people's crimes. You don't know for sure that anybody actually did something wrong. The main job is to just check to make sure everything is in order. And most of the time, you do not expect to find people that cheat. You do find some, but that's not your main job. Basically, what you find should be correct. Raklif amim, only once in a while, Esher is dominantly adolim so is a pshia. Once in a while, you find that they did something wrong. And even that, you don't know when you start looking at their records. You don't know for sure at the beginning that they did something wrong. Only after you investigate a little bit more do you find that out. what's our point here? So Rav Moshe is matir you being a tax auditor or some similar job for the government, which is important, so based on everything he says. But the act of omission is also important. What does Rav Moshe not say here? What reason does he not give that this is not a problem of Mesira? Based on what we just said a few minutes ago. What'd you say?
Lashon Hara.
Not Lashon Hara, but...
It's a fair government, so it's not Shaya.
Say again?
He did not say that as it's a fair government...
Right, that's what I had in mind. That Rav Moshe doesn't say that since the government is a Malchus Shel Chesed, it's a just government, that's the reason why Mesira doesn't apply. Rav Moshe gives very technical reasons here why it doesn't apply. The fundamental reason should have been that the government is doing something proper. They have rules, and the rules are okay. And that's the reason why there's no Mesira. Rav Moshe apparently does not accept that there's no Isra Mesira Bizman Hazeh. Apparently he doesn't accept that. Other posts can disagree. The Aruch HaShulchan in source number 10 disagrees. He says, Yadua l'chol korei hadoros, shebizman akadma b'dinos harechokos, that in the olden times, in faraway lands, lo haya l'ish bitachon b'gufo mamono, nobody had security, their physical security or monetary security. They did not have b'nei ha-shodim, v'anosim, all these bandits, av shenasu aleihem shem mishra, k'yadua gam hayom, eze b'dinos in Africa, ha-shod v'achamas, shepachos ha-mimshala, osim, shepachos ha-mimshala, Shepachot HaMemshala Osim Ve'al Tov Yizachu Malchei Europa. That basically what he's saying here is as follows, that in a lot of faraway lands, and this was like, you know, certainly way back in the day, that there were a lot of people that basically took on the rule of government, but really they were bandits, they were pirates, they were violent, and basically they didn't do very much as a government. And he mentions Africa specifically, which is interesting. And then he says the kings in Europe were Valtovi Zachru Malchei Europa. That the kings in Europe are considered to be really good. Uviyichud Adonenu. I thought he was going to say Moreno. He doesn't say Moreno. Hakera mi Russia. He says the Russian Tsar is the best one. Look at this. The Russian Tsar is considered to be the top of the paradigm of civilized governments. Can you believe that? What'd you say?
He wasn't writing from Russia, was he?
Belarusia. Belarus. Belarus.
He's not going to write the Tsar as the most evil anti-Semitic.
There you go. So that's a question. He might have written this for the censor, but the yesod that the Aruch HaShulchan is saying, I believe that this is discussed, by the way. Roy talks about this, but I think at the end of the day, most of them agree that that he meant the yesod that he mentions here is definitely he believes, even if the Tsarist Russia might not be the best example. He mentions also here Umalche Britannia, the governments in Britain. Ah, of course, the England is different, right? That, of course, nobody's going to argue with that, right? Certainly not the English people. He lived. This is probably written in the late 1800s, presumably. Late 1800s. Sheperishu Kanfei Mamshaltam Ba'arsos Arachokos, that the kingdom of Britain has spread their wings of their governments in all sorts of faraway lands, right? We might call that imperialism, us Americans, but or Australians. But it's called, yeah, okay. Anyway. That every single person can have security in both their money and their body. So that the rich people don't have to hide themselves away, and we won't read the rest inside, but basically that they shouldn't have to worry that people are going to take their money. So the Aruch HaShulchan basically says that the whole issue of Mesira only applies for not a real government, meaning government which is composed of bandits or pirates, but civilized governments, whoever they might be, are not included in the Isra Mesira, and you would be allowed and perhaps even obligated to inform to the law enforcement agencies of this type of government. Let me just finish up. This position is shared by the Tzitzel Eliezer of Waldenberg, agrees with that as well, in source number 11, which we'll not read inside. So we have a very, very important machlokas here between Rav Moshe on one side. The Chalkas Yaakov in source 13 also takes Rav Moshe's approach, that the Isra Mesira does indeed apply today. And other poskim, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Tzitzel Eliezer, and others, that it does not apply today. There are some in the middle also, which we're not going to read inside. The Shivat Halevi in source 12. I don't even know if I got the right quote here, but it's also in Breud's article, discusses it a little bit more. The Shevet HaLevi agrees that Mesira is permitted when the non-Jewish government, when their punishment is in accordance with halacha. If the government will punish something which is not against the halachic rule of what's supposed to happen to the person, then that would be okay, which basically anything which has to do with taxes would be okay because the non-Jews are allowed to, the government is allowed to collect taxes. But other rules perhaps might not be included. And again, the details we don't have time to get into right now, unfortunately. But that's somewhat of a middle position. So this is a big, big machlokas. In terms of reporting Jews, and it has not really been resolved today. So it's going to be basically a very case-by-case basis. One point that I will mention before we look at the scenarios is the following. Rabbi Breud points out in this article very, very fascinating points that have to do with the jail system. I don't know what it's like in England, but in America, it's actually a very serious problem.
In jail.
Yeah, that's a serious problem. That forgetting the issue of Masira, you're lucky if you just get beaten up in jail. So that's a very, very big question. What happens if you cause somebody to, you report on somebody, another Jew, they're going to go to jail, and then in the end, because they go to jail, they get beaten up, they get molested, whatever the case is, that's a serious, serious problem, that you're causing harm to come to that type of person. So so that could be a reason to, even if you agree with the position that you are allowed to be Moser, it could be that's a reason to agree with Moshe. And Rabbi Willig also, when he discussed this issue, Rabbi Willig also felt that was an important reason to take into account here. If the person's going to get beaten up in jail, then you have to know which jail is which and how it works. But so if that's a serious possibility, you got to be very, very careful.
You've got to a related question.
Yeah.
That it might be a just government, but the Tsarist Russia we're making today is just,
right,
but you're anti-Semitic.
I don't think that's going to make a difference necessarily. I don't think it's going to make a difference necessarily. I don't believe.
So just, just
other question of Moser. How much should you, let's say you, should you give up to not be Moser someone?
How much should you give up? Not, what's the case? In terms of the, meaning the case in the government, let's say, where the government tells you that you have to report.
Someone that I've got the
good question.
To save him,
right,
at a certain cost. What's the,
right,
cost?
Good question. The poskim don't discuss it. According to the shittas that say that you're obligated or at least allowed to report it, and then there's no problem. For sure, they would say that it's fine.
In the case where the person's actions are causing injury to somebody else, by not reporting him, would you be on over?
Okay, good question. The answer to that question we'll discuss in just a minute when we get to the scenarios. What time is it? We don't have much time left, right? Yeah, we got to end. We got to finish up. We'll come back to that question in just a second. The answer to your question, David, I think would be similar to before, meaning that even if it means that if you would lose... Okay, I'm not sure about this because I didn't see it discussed directly. But second,
you're doing an action when you're feeling it.
Right, so that's the question. If you're doing an action, but this is also only an Isra Darabanan, it's not an Isra Daraisa. So, okay, it's a good question. Would you say that you have to lose your job in order to not report the person? I would say if you take a broader perspective, that since there's a machlokas, there's probably room to say that you can rely on the opinions that that you'll be allowed to be most of them, but. According to the opinions that say that you're not allowed to be Moser, what would be the rules? That's a good question. I didn't see that question discussed directly. I have to look a little more carefully to see if anybody talks about it. Some of the situations that apply in that case, though, meaning some of the cases that you would be asking about might be, halacha might be different, which would be basically, we'll talk about them right now. Okay.
Where you said that if there wasn't a conflict between the punishment that would be given, you know, that's prescribed in the Torah,
right,
compared to the punishment that the government would,
right,
put, right? So how would that fit into a discussion, or what would be said about Israel in that case?
Excellent question.
Yeah. If you know someone's fiddling their taxes here, are you obliged to report them?
That's a good question. According to the positions we discussed last week, that Dina de Malchus Dina does not apply in Israel, the answer would be, of course not. According to the positions
that was only the Ron that
said that. And whoever else might have followed the Ron. According to other positions that would say that it is a problem of Dina de Malchus Adina, the question is like this. The Isser of Mesira might still apply to report to a Jewish government. If you would hold like Rav Moshe and Rav Waldenberg, it could be, again, they don't discuss it, but it could be that they would say that to report even to a Jewish government also might be a problem. Put it this way. If the Jewish government is not going to follow the Din Torah, then I think they would say that you shouldn't report them. If the Jewish government is going to do something which is not against halacha, so then you could have a question. Maybe they would say that it's the same thing, or maybe they would say, well, no, the whole Isser of Masira to begin with was only enacted for non-Jewish governments. So certainly in this case, if we have a Jewish government, especially if the Jewish government is somewhat just, then we would say that there's no problem necessarily to report them. However, I don't think the law in Israel is that you're obligated to report somebody who's cheating on their taxes. Okay, if the law is that you don't have to report them, I'm not sure that you should go about reporting them unless you're forced to. That's a question. I could hear a different opinion on that. I could hear a different opinion, but I'm not sure that that would necessarily be required. Rabbi Willig felt in the case of a non-Jewish government that in a situation of taxes where if you're not required to report them, then you shouldn't. Again, for a Jewish government, maybe it's different because there may not be an issue of Masira. Yeah.
In Dinei Mamonot, that is not symmetrical between Jews and non-Jews.
Okay.
For instance, Jews have a cause that they're rich, and non-Jew is not the same aloha than a non-Jew.
Right.
You don't expect a non-Jewish government to follow this non-symmetrical rule.
Okay.
So, and the government, from their point of view, is acting totally within the realms of what they how they should be policing.
Right.
So would the rule of them not following the Din Torah apply in a case like that?
So according to that shita of it's not Rav Moshe actually. It's actually Rav Vosner for the Shevet Halevi. He's the one that seems to support that opinion.
No,
I think he would say
that it would be according to the Torah.
So that case also involves a question of Erkos, which is, also gets into other issues, which I don't want to get into now. It's complicated. According to Rav Vosner, who basically says the idea is that it basically is only when halacha recognizes secular law. If it's something that secular law says something different, even though it's civilized and it's a normal rule, but it doesn't follow halacha, I think he would say that you can't be most of them. I think he would say that you cannot be most of them. That's what it sounds like here. I think he would say that you cannot be most of them. That's what it seems to be. Another question?
In America, I think there's a law on collusion and price fixing.
Yeah.
Which is that, maybe someone correct me if I get this wrong, but I think that if you have two companies which are illegally colluding to fix prices in a market, then whichever company basically reports it to the authority first gets off completely exempt, and the other one gets double the fines or something like that.
Okay.
Whereas if the authorities find out,
then
they both, it's sort of like a prisoner's dilemma. So if the authorities find out,
right.
they both get it. So now if you're one Jewish firm, there's another Jewish firm, and you've been colluding with them.
Uh-huh.
Was the case in Israel today? There was a case in Israel. Two major companies, one reported the other, and the second company is now
in America.
No, here in Israel.
I don't know if they have the same.
Wow.
They have the same thing. So the question is, if you're Jewish company number one, you know, are you obliged or even obligated to report?
Good question. So I think we would say
first,
that first. So I think in this case, even according to Rav Vosner and the Aruch HaShulchan and the Sitz Eliezer approach, I think even Rav Vosner would agree that where Dina de Machus Adina tells you that you have to report them, then they might say, okay, I'm going to take that back. If Dina de Machus Adina tells you, the law tells you that you have to report them,
the law says you're not allowed to be doing what you're doing, and basically they mitigate your penalty if you're the first one to confess.
I see. So there's no problem with confessing about yourself. Once you confess about yourself, you have to say the person that you're confessing
you
did it with.
You can't be lewd by yourself.
You have to say where. Right. You have to tell you who you're doing with. That's all you're doing with. That's a good question. So again, according to the opinion that says the Mesira is mutter, for sure, you would say that they're allowed to do that. According to the other opinion, I think we would still say that that if Dina de Machus Adina tells you that that the law requires you to report them. If the law requires you to report them, I think we would say that probably you should report them. If it's something that, it doesn't require you to, it allows you to, and you know they're going to catch you anyway, is that already...
Well, they may not.
Right, they might not catch you. So that's going to be more of a question if the other firm is Jewish. Again, in Eretz Yisrael, as we mentioned, there might be reasons why Eretz Yisrael is different to begin with, because the government is Jewish. But in a non-Jewish government, to report another firm that's Jewish is going to be a big question, and... Again, in that situation, being that there's a machlokas, I think there's room to rely on the opinions, which I happen to think are logical anyway, that Mesira doesn't apply bizman hazeh to just governments. So I think there's room to rely on that if you want to. But according to the Shita of Rav Moshe, I don't know. Not sure. It's not clear.
Actually,
You might say that that's a problem.
I actually have a client.
I'll get back to you. If I find more information about that case, I'll have to get back to you.
I actually have a client who's on facing criminal charges in the U.S. and could have seriously reduced his sentence by giving evidence against his co-defendants and potential and people who could potentially become co-defendants, all of whom are Jewish, and his Rebbe told him he's not allowed to do it.
Wow. So I guess he felt that if he's following Rav Moshe's opinion, then you gotta stick with it. You gotta go all the way. Again.
So is he a hero or is he a...
That's a question. It depends on your perspective. It's a very difficult issue. I'll just share with you one. One comment of Shlomo Zalman Orbach here. Is he a chassid, right? He might be a chassid. He's a chassid either way.
It's some people's eyes, he means.
Chassid doesn't mean chassid that he did the right thing. Chassid means that he followed his Rebbe. That's what chassid means, right?
So he did Shuvah.
Shlomo Zalman Orbach is quoted here in one of the books. Shlomo Zalman Orbach was asked about a similar question. Let me just mention this.
No,
Shlomo Zalman reports. Sorry, time is running late here. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was asked the following question about a particular Jew who stole a large sum of money and he was caught by the police in America. He was sentenced to a number of years in prison in America. The question that he was asked was it proper to assist in the collection of money for him, $200,000, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of redeeming captives, to have him redeemed from prison? Meaning, is there a mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim to redeem this guy, basically, for bail? Yeah, exactly.
Is this for bail?
Yeah, basically. He says possibly for bail. Possibly for bail. So what's the answer? When Shlomo Zalman heard this, he stated, redeeming captives? What is the mitzvah of redeeming captives here? The mitzvah of redeeming captives is only when the Gentiles are grabbing Jews irrationally for no proper reason and placing them in prison. According to what I know, says Shlomo Zalman, in America they do not irrationally grab Jews in order to squeeze money from them. I hope he's right. Hope he's right. The Torah says, yeah. Do not steal, and he stole money. On the contrary, it is good that he serve a prison sentence so that he learns not to steal. Very interesting. This is where Shlomo Zalman. Very similar to your case.
Actually, by raising that bail money and taking him out of prison, you're reducing his exposure potentially to... I mean, you're reducing his exposure to potential harm in prison.
Okay, so that's a good point. If we accept the point about the jail that we mentioned before, I think that I would agree.
Yeah,
and I think...
It almost depends on the jail.
You're right.
Money.
100%. You have to find out. You got to find out. You got to find out. That's an important point. You got to investigate which jail he's in and what the cases are. Send the prison rabbi, the prison chaplain, into the jail to find out what's going on there, and they can come back and tell you is it really bad or not. And if it's really bad,
then
I think
an
economic...
If it doesn't come back, then you...
If it come back, you know you have a problem. We need to wrap it up. You know what? I'm going to have to hold up on your question.
The government does arrest people for their money. I mean, they use prison as a mean of pressure for him to give information on where other people are, who his co-defender, who his co-conspirators are.
Right.
So they're not arresting Jews, but they're arresting people.
Right.
Every government does it as a way of a means of pressure for information.
No, you can't just, North Korea, you can't just pick people up off the street and say, give me the information, I'll throw you in prison.
You can arrest someone and say there's a very strong risk of you running away, of you doing this, and have him in jail.
So there is a system?
It's a justice system. You're right, but it's a system. Right, it's a system. I understand. I think that most of the postmen would still consider that to be, as long as it's a system and it's not random, I think they would say it's okay. Unfortunately...
It's a system also. I mean, it wasn't...
Economy. So it depends. In the case of Shlomo Zalman, would have said... Okay, it's a good question, and it requires more discussion, which unfortunately we don't have time for that right now. Very briefly, the last two cases here. So case two with the taxes and the donors. An Orthodox group was accepting tzedakah donations from many members of a certain Jewish community with writing tax receipts, and then tax deductible receipts, and then they returned 95% of the money to the donors afterwards. It was all a scam. One of the donors was discovered by the authorities, and during the investigation, he revealed the names of nearly 24 other donors who had also given money to this organization. The others were promptly arrested. Was it allowed for the donor, quote-unquote, to incriminate other Jews in this manner? This was a true case in a community in America, which you may or may not know what it is. Apparently, this was a very famous case. We're not going to get into the details now. This is a very big question based on what we've said so far. According to Rav Waldenberg and according to the Aruch HaShulchan, the answer would be, yeah, absolutely, it's mutter for him to arrest to reveal everybody else as well. He probably also was under pressure from the authorities. According to Rav Moshe, presumably this situation would not be something which would be mutter to reveal. According to the Shevet HaLevi, it could be that it would be mutter because we're talking about taxes here. Again, also depends on where the jail is. The jail factor has to be considered here as well. Where are they being sent to jail? That's another important question. Case three, this is the key point that I just wanted to make sure we get to. A group of people strongly suspect that a Rebbe at one of the local yeshivas is molesting children in his class. Unfortunately, this has happened way too many times. They have spoken with the school administration, but nothing has been done about it. Are they allowed to report them to the authorities? Are they allowed to leak the story to the media? So the bottom line here, this is a very serious issue. The halacha here is that according to everybody, all the posts can agree this is mutter. We don't have time to read it inside, but if you look at source number, seven. What?
You're not sure.
One second. So that's a good question. Source number seven. The basic halacha is that source number seven, anybody who is distressing the tzibor, if they are basically scandalizing or robbing or whatever they're doing to the entire community, that the entire community is affected, the Shulchan Aruch says in source number 7, you are allowed to inform on. And that's according to all the poskim. So child molesting, robbing, physical harassment, assault, all these kinds of cases, according to all the poskim, are mutter, absolutely mutter to inform. However, the way you have to do it is you got to go through the scale. You start with if we're talking about a school, in a school, a rebbe in a school, you start with the administration of the school. If they don't respond, then the next step is maybe to go to the authorities. Very rarely would you say that it should be allowed to be leaked to the media, because as we mentioned before, the media, number one, sometimes distorts the stories. There are other problems as well. There was a very famous case in New York about however many, 7 years ago, which I think everybody knows about already, of a rebbe principal that this exactly happened to. It was leaked, or the newspaper investigated it, and one of the major newspapers in New York read a big article about it, and that's how they found out about him and basically threw him, put him into, basically got
after
what you say?
It was ignored.
100%. So in that case, the newspaper, there was a big scandal because some people got upset at the newspaper. How can you do this? This is Lashon Hara. You're ruining his reputation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The newspaper's response, well, we tried. We went to the organization that also employed him in addition to the school, the major Jewish organization in America that employed him. We went to them. They didn't want to listen. They turned a blind ear. We tried other people. Nothing worked. So we felt this was our last, this was the only thing we could do to stop what he allegedly was doing. They had a lot of evidence.
He was a Jewish newspaper.
Yes.
When you talk about distressing the Sibyl,
it was not YU. And we're not going to say who it was, because we don't know what it was. You can ask me afterwards. I can tell you.
When you talk about distressing the
Sibyl. I'll talk about it. I just don't want to... It's not relevant for the Shear exactly who it was, so we don't have to get into it.
When you're talking about distressing the Sibyl, is it the fact here that in your scenario it says a group of people, that it would be different if one person had a suspicion? Could one person...
What do you mean one person has a suspicion?
Well, you said that the
no.
If one person has a suspicion, Sibyl is being distressed.
Right.
But if it's one person,
If it's one person who's being distressed, then the answer is that it's much more of a question of whether Masira is allowed or not. If it's a question of pikuach, if it's a question of serious, let's say potential loss of life or other equally serious concerns, it could be that even for an individual, it's also okay. But that's going to be much more complicated. If it's just that they're oppressing one person and not a group of people, then it's already a little bit more muddled. That's not so clear, and you have to investigate every case individually. If it's one person that suspects that he is, getting a group of people, then already it's a little bit better. Then you would say it's okay. The question is, if you're not sure, meaning if you have a lot of evidence to support the notion, then I think it's mutter to go to try to investigate. If it's something which is a suspicion, but you don't have a lot of evidence to back it up, so I don't know if you would say that you can report them to the authorities to get them in trouble. What you can do is get them to launch an investigation, which at the end of the day, if in the end he's guilty, then absolutely, then it would be mutter, then that's okay. But to go right away and go to the authorities and say he's guilty and make up some story and then they'll take him and put him in jail before investigating, I don't know if that would be okay based on what we said previously. If you're not sure, that's not allowed. If you might be sure and there's a way to do it with the proper authorities, then...
The authorities can't put him in jail unless they have a certain amount of evidence.
100%. So I think to launch an investigation...
So
100%. I think to launch an investigation to any of these kinds of cases that we mentioned, of molestation and harassment, et cetera, would be mutter.
In this specific area, actually... I was involved in an investigation two investigations in the UK. what they do is they arrest the person,
right?
Remove him from
right.
the equation,
right?
And then they conduct the investigation.
At the UK.
Yeah,
that's different than the United States. It's very different than the United States.
I've heard this before. They'll bail him and whatever, but then they'll conduct the investigation, because then they've already started the process, and they know that he's...
My experience in the U.S. was the opposite. You first have to have an investigation.
The case is different. They need
to have probable cause for an arrest, and that's based on acquiring a certain amount of evidence. Not as much as a conviction,
Okay, Beseder, I think we're finished for tonight. Bottom line is just that, as the one point, if somebody who hits other people or is violent... So that case, the Ramah says you can inform on him, even if it's only an individual. Even if he just hits or is violent to one person, that's still
a
lot. That's still
what?
Yeah.
What
about, okay.
You
what about a woman
who's
in
Jewish,
a...
Who goes around the bottom
of the beach. Okay.
Jewish, who goes around the bottom
of the beach. That's your talk, everyone.